It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Yesterday, the House Ways and Means Committee approved making last year's tax cuts permanent for individuals. The Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation says that the bill would raise the debt by more than $600 billion over the next decade. Last year's tax cuts are already estimated to add $1.5 trillion to the national debt. That's according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. We want to find out what tax cuts 2.0 mean, and if they will even get through a vote of both houses. Representative Gwen Moore sits on the Financial Services Committee and joins us now. And we are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Congresswoman Moore, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Carrie. Good morning.
Good morning. So Ways and Means actually voted on more than one tax bill yesterday. What did they do?
Yesterday, the Ways and Means Committee did what we called Tax Cut 2.0.
Right.
And what they want to do is make the individual tax cuts permanent. But these individual tax cuts are not for your everyday Americans, but individuals who are higher income individuals. My supposition is that they're trying to shore up support before the midterms. And I think your lead-in really spelled it out well, that it really only adds more to the deficit over 10 years.
Mm.
And it is really unclear to me whether this will be able, garner the votes on the floor.
So Paul Ryan has said he wants to bring votes to the floor, but you don't even think your Republican colleagues will vote for this?
Well, you know, as you know, there are folks who love to call themselves deficit hawks.
Hmm.
And if you're a deficit hawk, it's time to step up. We're going to talk about the consequences of the Lehman collapse at some point. But one thing we do know is that increasing debt is a threat to our economy. And this is so counterintuitive toward having a healthy economy that there's got to be some sort of dissension within the Republican conference, I think.
So you just said that this is to shore up their donors. So are there people who are putting this forward, do you think, simply to signal their donors and they're not really counting on getting it through necessarily?
Well, you know, it's hard to guess because,
right,
like I said, it's so counterintuitive for number one, the health of our economy. And secondly, you know, as we have seen the campaign, rely on these tax cuts in terms of shoring up votes for the midterm, they haven't been that popular.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Polls have shown that they are not that popular even among average Americans. We're talking to Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who is from the 4th District, which encompasses Milwaukee. And we're taking your calls for Congresswoman Moore, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, yes, right now I do want to get to the Lehman Brothers collapse and the financial crisis. You are on the Financial Services Subcommittee. This is the 10th anniversary of that crisis. What have we learned from this crisis, and are we doing anything to stop it in the future?
Oh, my God, Carrie. I remember the day that Hank Paulson showed up saying, give us $700 billion or else. The global economy is going to collapse. And, of course, my first instinct was to say, oh, heck, no, I'm not doing this. But I realized that not only was this a risk to our economy, but this was a threat to the global economy. And we had no choice. And I think, I sat there on the financial services panel and we put together Dodd-Frank. And we put some guardrails around the economy, tried to put together an orderly liquidation facility so that banks could unwind safely without being a systemic risk. We tried to put a regulatory regime in place. But we have seen a very systemic deconstruction of of Dodd-Frank under Republicans, which I think is frightening. When you look across the pond at Europe, they seem to have learned a little bit more than we have in terms of, you know, being concerned about risk and keeping a regulatory regime in place. But we have seen this Republican conference sort of try to deconstruct the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, raise the threshold at which banks can operate. And, of course, this debt, even the actions yesterday of the Ways and Means Committee that thrust us further into debt, we know historically our threats long term. We've seen it over the course of our history here in the United States, that when you have a lot of debt, when you have a lot of income inequality and lowered regulatory regimen, that it is it's just the perfect cauldron for a storm.
So walk me through this. How does having more debt lead to a financial crisis?
Well, I mean, more debt leads to a financial crisis because you have less money being used for productive purposes. I mean, you literally find yourself paying off monies that are owed.
Right, loans.
Right, right. Not just loans, but just the cost of borrowing.
Right.
It goes toward the cost of borrowing rather than building a new capital, making capital improvements, giving higher wages, making investments. It's just paid toward the debt, paying down the debt.
So we're not rebuilding bridges instead?
We're not rebuilding bridges. We are simply paying for the cost of borrowing.
So what do you say to people who say, look, I got a tax cut and it's you know, $100 more a year that's in my paycheck, and I like that, so I want more tax cuts. What do you say to them?
Well, I tell you, $100 a month is real money to some, a
right.
year.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that'll be helpful around Christmas time. To have that $100, and I'm not, you know, as a woman who raised three children primarily by herself, I'm not sneezing at even a small amount of money. I mean, that's lunch money, that's gas in your car to get to work every week. But there's a couple of things people need to know. First of all, inflation will definitely eat up any raise that people have. Secondly, the raise that you get from these tax cuts are certainly not going to offset other expenses that you'll get. For example, I'm expecting fully in October for everybody's health care costs to jump, to leap because of things that we have done to the Affordable Care Act and sort of the misalignment of health care interests. Inflation, just regular inflation. And last but not least, the work that the Ways and Means Committee did yesterday does not provide permanent tax cuts for the folks we're talking about now. Those individuals.
Okay, we're gonna come back to that in a moment. We're checking in with Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who represents the 4th District in Wisconsin. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Congress is pretty busy these days trying to pass legislation before the midterm elections in November. We're checking in with Congresswoman Gwen Moore about what is likely to come out of the House in the next month or so. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Congresswoman Moore, you were talking a moment ago about the fact that what came out of Ways and Means yesterday does not provide a tax cut for everybody, for all incomes. What incomes does it provide a tax cut for?
Well, it provides a tax cut for the rich, and it provides them with the opportunity to give themselves stock buybacks and dividends. It favors that kind of income versus earned income.
I see.
Right. Adding insult to injury, I mean, our president announced that he's thinking of this strongly about allowing these investors to factor in inflation when calculating their capital gains tax liability. And it gives them another $102 billion tax cut over 10 years, and not one penny of it is any kind of productive use in the economy. It's just, it's a numbers game. Oh, you get to calculate in inflation. And so 90% of the benefits of this $100 billion capital gains tax cut would just go to the top 1%. The Ways and Means Committee, I'm not familiar with all the work that they did because I am an aspirational member of that committee. I'm not on that committee yet. But when they were tinkering around with the tax cuts, there was an elimination of the middle income. They tinkered around by lowering and raising some tax brackets,
mm-hmm.
and that did not inure to the benefit of the lowest income people.
Right,
as they moved tax categories around, and so I am good. I'm really, really eager to see the readout from that once it hits the floor.
I want to move on right now to talk about the Farm Bill. We've done a lot of reporting on this here. It expires at the end of this month. There are two sides to this Farm Bill. There are farmers who need government help in shoring up their industry. And then there are SNAP benefits, which generally have been going together. And there are some people in the in Congress who want to eliminate the SNAP benefits. What say you about this Farm Bill?
Well, I think the magic of the Farm Bill historically has been that that you bring farmers to the table and you bring people to the table and you work things out. And of course, there continues to be an effort to separate farmers from beneficiaries of SNAP, the food stamp program. And of course, that is catastrophic. We're seeing that in these negotiations. Sean Duffy from Wisconsin is on the conference committee for the Farm Bill. The bill is stalled.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that it's stalled is because these conservative lawmakers continue to focus on work requirements, drug testing, these sort of behavioral modification programs in order for people to receive food benefits. That forestalls any discussion of lowering these huge tax subsidies to wealthy farmers. They can't even get to the discussion of that.
Mm.
And so it's stalled out basically on this behavioral modification for people. And just let me tell you this. Wisconsin has not recovered as well as other states since the collapse. And, you know, you often hear our governor and the president, but our governor talk about how we've had the lowest unemployment rate in history or since blah, blah, blah. And the reality is that wages have not only been flat, but they've actually decreased when you look at inflation and other factors. And while we might have the lowest unemployment rate, it is not sustainable. There is not a house in Wisconsin, a two-bedroom apartment house anywhere in the state of Wisconsin that's a decent housing that you can afford off of a minimum wage job. And so it's not a matter of people not working. People cannot afford food and transportation and child care, medical care, off of these lowered wages. And so it is a total distraction to say, well, we're just going to make people work. People are working.
Okay, so when you talk to your colleague, Congressman Duffy, who says that this farm bill is going to get people to work and so that they can changing the SNAP benefits will get people to work and because they're capable adults, and you say to him, people are working and they're not making enough, what does he say back to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that because I've written him a letter and said to him, you know, Representative Duffy, I mean, there are in Wisconsin, there will be 76,000 people who will lose SNAP benefits under your proposal, 23,000 of them kids. And guess what? They're not all in the 4th Congressional District of Wisconsin. You know, they're in your district. In your district, you have people who rely on SNAP in the 7th Congressional District of Wisconsin. I mean, it is a very, very needy community. Mm. So I try to bring it home to him that it's not just those people in Milwaukee. It's folks in your district as well. And I think that...
Did he respond?
No, he did not respond to my letter.
So I want to move on to talking about how this applies to school lunches. The Farm Bill specifically applies to school lunches. Why should we pay attention to this?
We should definitely pay attention to school lunches and school breakfast. I think that our colleagues have fought against, I mean, again, it's an ideological battle. Their notion that kids ought to eat breakfast at home and parents ought to take primary responsibility for feeding their children. We don't live in the same sort of environment we've lived in. Parents are off to one of those jobs at 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I think breakfast and lunch at school improves academic performance. It improves kids' health. And there's really not any debate about that. And it is an investment in our children that pays us back 20-fold. It's immeasurable. And why we should put our children, who by definition, if they're school age, are dependent children, why we should lay them on the altar of sacrifice for ideology is just mind-boggling. And so I am hoping, Carrie, you know, to be able to convince people in Wisconsin and across the nation that investments in food are long-term investments that really will bring us the kind of harvest that we want to see. You know, I lived on food stamps for a period of my life, me and my little girl, and I say it every time the subject comes up. I'm so grateful to the taxpayers for feeding me and my little girl, and both of us give back tremendously. My daughter works with special needs children in our school system. I represent people in Congress. We both pay lots of taxes. And so, you know, hopefully the taxpayers have gotten those fish sticks and chicken nuggets back.
Right. I want to end today by talking about Hurricane Florence. What do you know and that is happening, and how is the government planning to respond to this? Are you satisfied here?
Well, you know, I'm pretty frightened about Florence. When you consider the response, the rhetoric, at least, of the president in just being tone deaf to what happened in Maria with Puerto Rico, to see...
I should note that the president said that it was a total success, that the cleanup was a total success in Puerto Rico.
That's right, it was a total success.
3,000 people didn't die.
Right, and 3,000 people did not die, that, you know, that you know, Democrats just wanted to make him look bad. I talked to my colleague, Congresswoman Plaskett from the Virgin Islands. She says that they're still devastated in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so, you know, I'm concerned about what are the metrics for success here?
We have been talking to Congresswoman Gwen Moore. She represents Wisconsin's 4th District that covers the Milwaukee area. Congresswoman Moore, I wish we had more time. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, until we meet again, Carrie.
Thank you. We're inviting Wisconsin members of Congress to talk about current issues on The Morning Show. It's the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Dogs were the first animal to be domesticated, but experts don't know exactly when that happened. They are keen, though, to understand dog evolution as much for what it tells us about human evolution as what it tells us about dogs. Gregor Larson is an archaeologist and geneticist at the University of Oxford who studies domestication. He recently co-authored a paper in Science about how dogs native to North America evolved over thousands of years, then went extinct after the arrival of Europeans. Gregor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the story we always hear about dogs is that a really, really long time ago, humans befriended wolves and then eventually domesticated and bred them to become pets. But that may not be true because we don't actually know how dogs became dogs, do we?
Not so much, no. There's a lot of ideas out there about what that process may have entailed, but we don't have a lot of hard evidence for how you get from a wolf to a dog.
So it could have happened by accident?
I think there's quite a few people in the community who are thinking that it is that most things are by accident and that dogs really aren't any different in that regard. Or more accurately, the idea that people intentionally domesticated dogs by simply grabbing a wolf and bringing it into a camp with the idea of one day having a cute little puppy with floppy ears who would play with your four-year-old is perhaps a bit more far-fetched.
So I'm interested in this idea that domestication doesn't have to be intentional. Talk to me about this.
It's more that it's emergent. It's more that you have two different species, and that could be dogs, it could be cats, it could be sheep or goat or any number of other things that are very familiar to us now. And that what happens is that both populations of humans and animals start to become start living in very closer proximity, and as a result of that, the selection pressures on each of them start to shift a little bit, and so that what you end up with is a domesticated animal, or one we would recognize today, but that entire process is not something that was driven intentionally by people who had a very goal-directed idea of what they were starting out to do and then achieved that by applying a particular set of selection pressures over a period of time.
So talk to me about what we do know. I mean, this origin story about humans befriending wolves and what have you, I'm assuming at some point, we do know that dogs evolved from the gray wolf. Do we? Let's make sure of that first.
No, that we do know. That's absolutely fine.
Okay.
So, yes, and it was, curiously, though, it's a population of gray wolves that we strongly suspect was in the Old World, so somewhere in Eurasia. It looks like there are certainly gray wolves in North America, but the dogs that came in with people to North America were derived from Old World wolves rather than from New World ones.
Okay.
And though there may have been some genetic contribution from, so what I mean by New World is North America,
right.
South America.
Right.
And by Old World, I mean Eurasia, generally. So,
sure.
And very much like the people coming into the Americas, some of those people who came in brought dogs with them that were derived from wolves that were from Eurasia.
So we'll get to that in a moment. But the question here is, so we know that dogs derive from gray wolves, and humans interacted with them, didn't necessarily say, sit, gray wolf, right? They didn't actually try to domesticate them in that way. But what are some of the theories about how humans and gray wolves interacted that brought them closer together?
So here's one potential theory or one hypothesis for how this may have happened. We know that for a lot of species, what they can, they form ways in which they start to interact with an environment that will shift them a little bit. And they form these things called ecomorphs, which basically means that if you are, for example, a killer whale, there are some populations of killer whales that really like sea mammals and other populations of killer whales that do very well, but subsist on salmon instead. Mm. So if you have a bit of a Capulet and Montague situation, where it's the same species, they recognize each other, they pass each other, but they have very different ways of going about their daily business. And that becomes a culture, and that culture then gets embedded within the genes, so that when they give birth to pups, those pups get reared on a very specific diet, and that's how they learn, and they pass that knowledge along. So we know this is true in wolves as well. There are some wolves who follow caribou across Canada, and other wolves that just stick around mostly in the forest and consume a lot of other things, but are not migratory, and they don't have to follow things very much. So you could imagine a situation where there was a population of wolves that at some point began following a group of people, as though people were large herbivores in this case, but therefore they would have an incentive to protect them while they could subsist off of all of the waste products that humans were generating as they were moved up and down the landscape. And so through that process, then you get a tightening of that relationship, and that also helps to separate that population of wolves off from the other ones, and that reduces the amount of gene flow that you would have from other populations, which might then sort of resist the kinds of selection that were taking place as that population of wolves and people started to become more acclimated to each other and live in closer proximity to one another. And from that point on, that might be the first step. And from that point on, then you talk about a little bit more deliberate selection pressures, and maybe you get a dog from there. But the important point is that that's a biological mechanism by which, and we see that in a lot of other animals and a lot of other species, a mechanism by which you can get differentiation of populations that would lead to a slightly different way of living that might then get embedded culturally and that might get embedded genetically. And so that's one possible mechanism that we've been exploring.
I want to go back to, you said Capulet and Montague species. I love it when scientists quote Shakespeare to me, but is this something that you guys use to categorize?
It's more of it's something that we came up with a little while ago. It's just a way to sort of distinguish between two very close, I mean, it's the same species. Nobody's right. going to argue that Capulets and Montagues aren't, but there is such a big cultural division between the two that it actually limits gene flow between the two. And then we see this in the natural world as well. And it's not just in killer whales. We see it in foxes and in caribou and a range of other moose and a range of other taxa as well, where there is a cultural difference and a distinguishing between things. So they can reproduce, they just choose not to.
We are talking about the anthropology of dogs with archaeologist Gregor Larson of Oxford. What stories do you have about dogs in your life that shows how they connect with humans? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gregor, I want to get back to this how long does it take question. How long does it take to make this genetic transformation? And how long have dogs been domesticated?
Those are great questions, and ones that we're wrestling with. One thing that we know for sure is that what has happened over the last 200 years bears very little resemblance to the preceding 10 or 15,000 years. And simply because what the Victorians were very good at was classifying things and closing breeding lines and establishing the whole concept of now what we call a breed. The idea of a breed, in at least the Victorian sense, and the way that we now think of it, really didn't have any purchase or any real analog in the preceding 10,000 years of human-animal relationships. And so that entire idea of what a dog is, so when we think about what the origins of dogs are, we're often very, our perception is colored by our recent experience, which is born of just the last century or two. And as a result of that, I think that really limits our understanding of what dogs were and how they related with people over the preceding millennia. I mean, another example of that is we've got a huge archaeological data set that we're looking at. And when we look at the bones, we find it very difficult. We can distinguish dogs from wolves going back to about 1600 AD. So for the last 300, 400, 500 years. Prior to that, though, it becomes very, very difficult. And so the really And for a lot of people, when there's a story of how the Irish greyhound or the Irish wolfhound went extinct because it was so good at eliminating wolves from the Irish countryside. Well, at the time that was supposed to have taken place, a lot of archaeologists I know say that there were no wolves in the Irish countryside. And that this idea is that there were probably more a lot of feral dogs out there. But at the time, nobody was really distinguishing that much between wolf and dog. And so because we now have a very strict definition of those two things, we tend to impose that upon the past and expect it to be there. And when it's not, we get very confused.
So talk to me about research done on dog remains in a site in Siberia, where scientists postulated that some dogs may have been used to pull sleds, others eaten, others sacrificed for religious purposes.
Absolutely. And one thing that's very true about dogs that isn't so true of other animals is the degree to which they have integrated into human life. And dogs have been doing jobs for us for a ridiculously long time, and a variety of jobs that no other animal can even hope to achieve. I mean, you're not going to have cats smelling out bags in Kennedy Airport, or a domesticated goat telling you when you're next going to have an epileptic fit. You know, these kinds of things are not the kinds of things that other animals do. But so, and the really nice thing is that for the study that you're talking about, there is a site that's about 9,000 years old where they have all, it's very well preserved. It's in the high Arctic of Siberia, and they have very nicely preserved material culture and the actual sled runners and leather and all kinds of things. So yes, dogs were being used a very long time ago to pull sleds across the tundra landscape.
We have a question from Chris in Milwaukee. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. So, Professor, I have a question. Just from the other side, you know, we talk about us domesticating the wolf and or the ancestors and descendants. How about from the other perspective? What do you think, and this is obviously maybe a little tricky to answer, do you think that the wolf accepted us as humans into their packs?
That's a great question, Chris.
Yeah, and you know, I completely agree. In fact, one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to upend this whole notion of what domestication is. It's one of these terms that everybody uses and throws around pretty casually and thinks that they have an intuitive idea of what it means. But when you drill down into it, it doesn't really, you know, every single person is going to have at least two definitions of it. And I think that this idea of us domesticating something has been so, is such a strong idea that we hold on to that when it gets countered, the opposite of that appears to be, oh, well, cats domesticated us or dogs domesticated us. And that's funny because it inverts the idea, but I think both of them are wrong. I think that nobody domesticated anybody. I think that what we're talking about is emergent relationships and emergent differences in behavior and the way that things look solely as a result of a shifting of the selection pressures associated with two species getting together. So it's got a lot more to do with symbiosis and those ideas within biology than it does to have with anybody directing this process, whether that's the animal or the human.
We are talking with Gregor Larson about the anthropology of dogs and how dogs have evolved to from gray wolves to be domesticated animals and lots of different species of domesticated animals. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be back with more on dogs in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Oxford archaeologist and geneticist Gregor Larson thinks that the world would look a lot different if domestication of animals had never happened. And because the first animals to be domesticated were dogs, Larson is determined to find out how that happened. But the answers are few and far between. What do you think about what dogs know and don't know about humans? Do you think your dog reads your emotions? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gregor, I want to ask about dingoes. Dingoes are an Australian dog, and we had a listener write in to say that dingoes don't seem to want to be domesticated in the way that that other dogs have been domesticated. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, dingoes are interesting, and I think what they really nicely demonstrate is the fluidity of the relationship that dogs and people have had through time and how you can go in lots of different directions. So, you know, right now we have wolf populations and human populations. They don't really have that much to do with each other, and they kind of stay away from each other. And you've got dog populations and human populations where the dogs are, you know, like completely more at home with people than they are with other dogs. And they become sort of obligate human children in a way from both sides of that relationship. And we know from dingoes that there were no canids in Australia. They were brought there by people. And if you're bringing a canid with you, you're not really bringing a wild wolf with you. So the dingoes in Australia are clearly descended from dogs, which are descended from wolves. And then they get out, they go feral, and they start occupying a landscape which may have already been a bit denuded of quite a few of the very large-scale carnivores that were there. And then it was the population was able to then survive away from humans. And so a kind of reversion or feralization of that process, as we refer to it as sometimes. So they represent a really interesting case study of how you can go from, very simplistically wild to domestic and back again.
We talked at the beginning about you wrote an article in Science magazine about the extinction of dogs in native North America. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun because we just did not expect that at all. In fact, when we first started this study, we were focused exclusively on Eurasia because everybody at that point knew, of course, that dogs in North America, though they were there, that everybody thought it was just a backwater, really, of East Asia, and that whatever was going to be there was going to be related to dogs that were already found in China or Eastern Siberia. And we started sequencing the genomes of a handful of them and then quite a few more of them, and we realized, much to our surprise, that all of the dogs that were in North America prior to the arrival of the Europeans were represented a completely distinct and unique lineage of dogs that didn't exist anywhere in the old world and certainly didn't exist anywhere else that we could find, despite the fact that there had been tens of thousands of dogs that had their genome sequenced. So then when we looked through that through time, we realized that at least 90-95% of that entire lineage has vanished after the arrival of Europeans. So following Columbus, a lot of Europeans arrive, they bring their Eurasian dogs with them, and they replace all the Native American dogs that have been there for the last 10,000 years. And how that happened and whether that was a factor of biology or disease or persecution or culture or some combination thereof, we're not entirely certain, but we cannot find any modern dog that really bears any relationship whatsoever to the dogs that were there just 500 years ago.
Wow, and the closest living match to their DNA isn't a dog, is it?
No, and that was even the crazier thing, is that there's a cancer called canine transmissible venereal tumor. It's the world's worst STD. Instead of kissing somebody and coming down with something that you can easily fix, you get a tumor, and it attaches to yourself. And so we can look at this tumor, and we can see an unbroken lineage going all the way back, because it's not that it develops within you. It's just passed on from, in this case, dog to dog. And when we looked at the original genome of that tumor, we found that its closest ancestors were, in fact, these pre-Columbian dogs in North America. So that even though the dogs themselves don't exist, they now sort of exist as a tumor that's found in dogs that are globally distributed.
So maybe that's what killed them, and then that's what lived on?
It seems unlikely. The cancer is not very... it doesn't kill the dogs. You can live with it for quite a long time. So, and because it's so closely related, we suspect that maybe the dogs in North America already had some resistance to it anyway, but maybe it was a different strain that came over. I mean, it's entirely possible. I mean, as I say, at this stage, we're really a bit baffled about how you can eliminate a population that size. Although having said that, what I find fascinating about this is that dogs are so close to people that wherever you go, if you find something that's true about the humans, that will also be true of the dogs. Right. And in this particular case, it's not just the ancestry, it's that the persecution of humans in North America when the Europeans came over was pretty complete as well. And so perhaps it's not a surprise that the dogs went the same way.
This is totally fascinating. We've got Gary from Boscobel on the phone. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest if he has any insight on the idea of especially paleo, early paleo people, and interacting with wolves, not necessarily allowing them into camps, enticing them to stay near camps with food scraps and bones and stuff. Those early paleo people were subject to a lot of big meat-eating predators, and to have a group of dogs near the camp as an early warning system or even a way of fighting off big predators would seem to me to have been a very valuable asset.
That's a great question, Gary. Thank you for that. Gregor?
Yeah, no, that sounds entirely plausible. And dogs have been serving as sentries for a very, very long time. And there are certainly dogs that play that role for modern pastoralists who protect flocks of sheep and do a very good job of it, and not just warding off other wolves, but lots of other stuff. And that kind of gets back to what I was saying before about the ecomorphs, that as soon as a wolf becomes incentivized to protect a resource, and if that resource is being able to subsist off of a human niche, then yeah, it will act as a sentry and protect that resource and even go so far as fighting off whatever might be trying to come for the people.
You have theorized that dogs were domesticated not once, but twice. Explain that to us.
Well, this is just a working hypothesis that we have, in that we have both archaeological evidence, which shows that the earliest dogs that we can find in Eurasia are on the very east side and on the very west side. And in the middle, there's plenty of people, but there's no dogs for a very, very long period of time. And then we look at the modern genomes combined with some ancient genomes that we've got. We again see this very deep split. So there are East Asian dogs and Western Eurasian dogs. And the split seems to be older than the first appearance that we can find in the archaeological record. So that seems to suggest to us that there were two separate lineages of wolves, both of which went independently through this process of domestication and then later came together, and there's been a big mixing from there. So it seemed to fit the data at the time, and we've got a ton more data coming through the door right now that we're going to evaluate within the context of that hypothesis and test it and see how true it is. But for the time being, I don't think it's not out of the question.
So what would human history look like if dogs had never been domesticated?
Yeah, another really good question. I mean, I think if you eliminate domestication writ large, then certainly you don't have 8 billion people on the planet. You've got maybe a couple of 10 million or so, which is about what it was prior to 11 or 12,000 years ago. You certainly don't have anything. I mean, we are effectively mobile bands of hunter-gatherers subsisting on a landscape and, doing it pretty well and pretty effectively. But there's no such thing as money or writing or economics or history or politics, at least on the kind of scale that we're used to. I mean, none of this stuff exists. And that only emerges as you get very large population sizes. And humans on the planet today are entirely dependent upon big populations of domestic plants and animals, when the irony is that most of us don't ever see the production of those things. We just know that they exist somewhere, usually in kids' storybooks, but we're very happy to subsist on them, because without them, we wouldn't be here.
So Gary kind of had this right, that wolves protected humans, and then humans then kind of protected the wolves.
Although which order that comes in and right. Who's responsible for what, I mean, again, I come back to this idea of emergence, that it's really both of those populations kind of doing a kind of romantic circling dance, and then everything comes out of that, but never as a directed process where somebody's saying, that wolf would be very good at warding off something because it's happened. There's got to be an incentive for the wolf to be doing that in the first place, and I don't know how you get a person to make that incentive.
Gregor Larson is an archaeologist and geneticist at the University of Oxford who studies domestication. He's been talking to us about the anthropology of dogs. Gregor, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. You are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
All dogs go to heaven.
I miss my dog.
Heaven.
I kiss my dog.
Heaven.
I miss my dog.
Heaven.
I kiss my dog. My dog had a name. Keep it his name alive. If I had to leave hell on earth.
All dogs go to heaven.
My dog had a name.
I'm gonna sing his name.
Keep it his name alive.
I'm the one to blame.
If I had to leave,
he would do the same.
Hell on earth.
Walking through the flames. Heaven.